Hey everyone, it's Wei Chun here, and I'm doing this sort of do-over introduction because my actual introduction for our guest during the podcast itself was not very good. So this is like a makeover, right? A do-over. Our guest is Christopher Tan. Christopher started out as a financial advisor who did very well, but eventually he felt like the industry standard sort of commission-based model was not the way to go. So he started his own financial management firm called Provident, which did things a different way, via a fee-only model. Now, we'll explain the differences between these models inside the podcast, right? But the gist of it was that this is not an easy thing to do, and a lot of people didn't like that he did this thing, and Christopher faced a lot of opposition from the industry when he did this. Basically, this guy just brought something new to Singapore when it comes to getting professional financial advice and how you pay for that professional financial advice. Despite that opposition, he persevered. Then, 2 decades later, Provident has become one of the most reputable and respected wealth advisory firms in Singapore and I think the region also. So we'll kick off the show with Chris describing the turning point in his career, why he decided to turn away from the traditional way of commission-based financial advisory to a fee-only financial advisory. So have a listen and I hope you guys enjoy the episode.
I started, my work in the financial services industry as an insurance advisor. Spent 3 years in the insurance industry. I was top rookie in the first year when I was with that insurance company. And then by the third year, I was earning about 200 over 1,000.
Wow.
At the age of about 30, 31 years old.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, so that was 2000, 2001. 20 years ago, I think 200,000 is quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right? Even today, it's quite a lot of money. But I wasn't happy because I wasn't doing what I like. And the turning point came when one of my clients, big clients, and I was trying to recommend him a policy. And then he looked at me and he said, Chris, I like you, right? Every time you come, you propose something, I will buy something from you. But at some point in time, surely I don't need to buy any more insurance. Mm. That was a turning point because I actually felt very bad. I felt very lousy because all the while I thought I was helping him. But actually he was like supporting me,
Okay.
So that started Provident. And when we started Provident, we had one thing in mind. We wanted it to be different. We wanted it to be a financial services firm that is a professional service firm set up, not a sales organization. We started as a fee-only practice. I guess in the earlier days, it was difficult. Even today, running a fee practice is not easy. But in the earlier days, it was even tougher because it took many years for us to actually survive.
Right.
And then finally, the business picked up. And that's where we are today.
So I think for people who do not know how FAs are remunerated, so it's commission and then it's fee-based, right? Is there anything in between?
Yeah, so globally, there are 3 ways that financial advisory firms or even advisors, they are compensated. Okay, firstly, commission-based. That one, all of us are very familiar.
Yep.
The advisors, they don't get paid unless you buy something from them.
Mm.
The second way is actually fee-based, right? Fee-based means that the advisors will charge a fee, but at the same time, he will take commissions.
Mm.
And sometimes if the commissions are huge enough, he may waive the fee, right? The third is fee only. Actually, that's us, right? So fee only means you only take a fee, you don't take commissions. If there are any commissions that comes up because of any transactions, the commissions are fully returned back to the clients. Or if possible, we use products that will not pay commissions. Yeah, so of the three, I think, my opinion is fee-based is the worst, right? I'd rather an advisor charge me commission rather than fee-based, because fee-based is like, 没有意思, right? I charge you a fee, usually not very high. But actually, really, I want to get the transaction, right? Because that's where I am paid most, right? So I feel the fee-based is like an in-between, neither here nor
there.
It's
like worst of both worlds.
I think so, I think so. So if I'm a consumer, I rather engage a 100% commission-based advisor.
Yep.
At least I know where you're coming from, right? Or a fee-only. In between is, I feel, neither here nor there. Fee-only is not unique. It's only unique in this part of the world. In fact, we think that fee-only, we are probably the first, not just in Singapore, but Southeast Asia, right? Because, the next most advanced market, it's probably Hong Kong. Mm. But Hong Kong is not a very advisory market. It's a very trading market. So even in Hong Kong, we don't find any fee-only at that point in time. But fee-only is very common in countries like Australia, in US, in Europe, right? So we are not unique. I copied the model from the West.
Right.
Now, I am not saying that a commission-based advisor is less competent, it's unscrupulous and dishonest. No, I'm not saying that. But I think it's very important for us to recognize that commission presents an inherent conflict of interest. And the earlier the advisor acknowledge that, the better, right? What I don't get it is that whenever, I mean, 20 years ago when we first said that, wow, I kena hantam, you know, it's like, why do you say this, you know, all that. But I don't understand why we need to fight that, right? Because as long as we recognize that this is a conflict, and I find the best way to mitigate this conflict, that's fine. There's nothing wrong, right?
Yeah.
For you to
so
take
you're
commission.
Saying that if I acknowledge that, look, commission-based thing has a certain dynamic to it, and I upfront say it, there's still a way in which I can operate, you believe, in that model without being unscrupulous.
I think so 100%, right? Because not everyone is willing and need to pay a fee, and they need to get somebody to help them do something, and they must pay something.
Right.
And it's nothing wrong going to a commission-based person. I mean, we go to a property agent to get our property purchase done, and we pay a commission. We happily pay commission, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's perfectly fine, as long as we acknowledge it, and then we tell the clients, look, this is a potential conflict. These are the ways that I'm trying to mitigate for you. And I think that's totally fine.
I think we are probably that way about sponsor content also. Like, because creating sponsored content does have like a certain stank to it. People will position, people will like assume the content is like not so, will be like more biased, less objective.
Yeah.
But it's also about like declaring that, you know, yes, this dynamic does exist, and then you do things to kind of mitigate that. Right?
Yeah, I mean, consumers are not stupid, right? They know. And to me, it's the earlier we tell them that, look, this is the potential conflict, but this is what we do. I think the consumer appreciate it even more.
Yeah. I think to be fair also to the commission-based advisors, I think not everyone is willing to pay the fee required for a fee-only advisory.
That's right.
This is particularly true when you are like a fresh grad, don't have a lot of money, right? Then you cannot afford to pay like a few thousand dollars for advice. And therefore, commission makes more sense in that scenario.
Yeah, totally agree.
Once your needs become like bigger, you have more money, then I think fee only or fee based starts to become an option.
Yeah, so I mean, over the last 20 years, this is what we realized as well, because we have people coming to us inquiring and they want to be our clients, and then we know actually they really need not pay us a fee, because it's a very simple advice that we can give, right? So if we onboard you as a client, firstly, you are paying for something that you shouldn't pay. Secondly, I feel that it is also not commercially viable for us, right? So then we don't want to get into a relationship. But this particular person actually really, really needs help, right? Yeah. So then they should go somewhere else and find a trusted advisor. And if the trusted advisor takes a commission, but does a competent job, is honest about it, nothing wrong.
Yeah, I think as a very layman person who was always very suspicious of agents of any kind, insurance or wealth management, like, that was sort of the gripe that I always had, because I always was like, I told my guy, like, dude, like, if you want to sell me something, I would trust you more if you just told me what is your kick. What do you get from this? We all need to earn money. I'm okay with that. But the way that this is written, but the way that he told me, like, which I think also kind of makes sense, is that, look, I think you are a bit different from my other customers, because most people, if I tell them that stuff up front, along with that long kind of thing where I project all the returns and stuff, right? It's so much information that it becomes very, very hard for me to sell to somebody who's a layman in the industry. I don't know this world. I have no idea how to even interact with it. If there's too much information overload, like, it's very hard for me to even process all of these things. So is there a way that you think, like, we should go and approach the people who are not so rich?
Yeah, I mean, I always believe that even for clients, right, if you are going to use any advisor, including Provident, I feel that it is in your interest actually to be financially literate yourself first. Don't leave everything to your advisor, because it's your money, right? So you need to probably read up more about these things yourself, visit some blogs, go and attend conferences, get yourself I mean, you are not trying to be an expert, right? But at least you know what is out there in the area of insurance, why some people say they advocate term insurance, why another camp say that, you know, they believe in whole life. And then at least you know what's the argument. In the area of investments, understand things like active versus passive, understand low cost and all that. Then you're better prepared. Then when you go and see your trusted advisor, you can have a very good discussion with the advisor.
Right.
It also allows you to gauge and judge whether, hey, is this person really conflicted?
Right.
Right. And whatever things that he shows me, is it really for my interest? You know, things like that. I think it's just not wise to just go to an advisor and say, you know, I don't know anything about numbers. I hate numbers. You know, and then I trust you fully.
Yeah.
Right. And I just want to say this. It is not that commission-based advisors are dishonest. I've said that, right? And I've said that as long as you mitigate, you'll be fine. But it's not easy. It is not easy.
But for the agent, is it?
Yes, it's not easy, right? I find myself in that shoe when I first started, right? Between one product and the other product, it's not easy when I see a huge difference in commission.
Right.
For me to overcome that and say, I will sell you a cheap term. And it becomes even harder when the community that I'm involved, that I'm in, they also do the same thing.
Yep.
It's not easy when recognition is based on commission.
Recognition as in the MDRT,
the awards, the incentives, right? It's not easy. It takes someone who is very, very strong to say, look, okay, I know this product is actually better for the client, although it pays me lesser. It is okay when my manager say, why are you so silly? It is okay when I sit down and watch all my colleagues go up on stage and collect all the awards. Yeah. It is okay that they are traveling to all the nice places and putting it on their Facebook.
Yeah.
But I'm doing the right thing. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people like that.
There are people like that.
Yeah, but it's just not easy to do this. Right. Yeah.
It kind of, the image of success kind of breeds more success. And because, you know, but I think more importantly is that people respond to that. The layman thinks that looking successful means that you are a great financial agent. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I think the consumers today are probably wiser. 20 years ago, maybe the consumers would think like that. When I first entered the industry, that was how I was taught as well. You know, I remember 20 years ago, there was an insurance agency that believes in getting brand new agents to buy the ticket first. Meaning to say, the agency manager will bring them to a car showroom and say, you buy the expensive car.
Well, when you say buy the ticket first, what does that
mean? Pay the ticket. That means you don't have the money, right? So you pay the ticket first. You find some ways to support the payment of the ticket later.
Leverage, like borrow money.
Yeah, and okay, those people who have been in the industry 20 years ago, you know what I'm talking about. So you go to the showroom, you buy the expensive car. So now I'm stressed because I got a huge loan to pay.
Yeah.
I will work my guts out to make sure that I will pay off that loan.
Right.
Right. And the idea also is that if I dress well, if I drive a big car, you know, and I wear flashy watches, you know, all that, it seems to suggest that I'm financially successful. And only because I'm financially successful, I can advise you.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm taking a bus and I'm staying in a HDB flat, how can I even advise you? You know? But I think that thinking is totally, totally wrong. Right? Because what we have materially doesn't suggest whether we are really rich. Right?
Absolutely.
And I always share with people that my clients come to me not because of my wealth. They come to me because of our wisdom. Right? So, but I think today, like I said, I think more and more consumers are beginning to realize that. And many of our clients that come to us, they are really rich, but they're not flashy either.
Oh, I love that. That's why I say quiet. I didn't mean it in the business not doing well. I really mean it in the non-ostentatious, just quiet confidence in I know my stuff and I know I'm okay. I don't need to show anybody else with my flashy watches or like the idea that signs of wealth will beget more wealth. I feel like there's something very nice about that should be, I think, sexier in Singapore.
Yeah, and I think, you know, birds of the same feathers flock together, right? That's the saying. So who you are and who you want to be, you will attract that kind of clients.
Right.
We really do not want to attract those kind of clients.
See, so
that
you also don't want.
I don't want. I don't want those clients that on a weekend, they invite you, you have to go to a yacht out there in the sea, and then go and swim with, you know,
sharks and dolphins.
Or skimply dressed, you know, people. I wouldn't want that, right? I will find it very stressful to catch up with that lifestyle. I also want to work with clients who are like ourselves. They have the wealth, but they're simple, conservative, family people. Because then we have a lot of things to in
same values,
to
right?
Easier to talk, right?
I think there's something to be said also when you kind of like show off like you're very wealthy to attract people. Sometimes you attract like the wrong type of
precisely
customer. Yeah. And this customer, like, they did not take the time to understand what wealth building is. When like the market goes down a little bit already, then they're like, hey, how come like that?
So I think it's the kind of clients that you also want to work with. And honestly, we can't fake it. The founders of Provident, we are all heartlanders. We all didn't come from a rich family.
You stay in HDB?
All my founders stay in HDB.
Wow.
Every one of us. And all our founders, I mean, we have a car. It's a simple car, Japanese car.
Family car.
Family car. And most of the time, we don't drive.
You took Grab down, right?
I took Grab. I take train because my wife takes the car. So I need to clarify, I do have a car, I don't drive because it's a family car. So we also can't fake it. We also don't know how to be rich.
Right? I love that.
We don't know how to buy a Jaguar, you know, and try and talk the rich man lingo because that wasn't our
upbringing. It reminds me of something that I love that you said on another show, the Michelle Martin interview at Fast TV. I really sometimes I look, and it took me a while to understand this, I think. I look at people who flash their wealth a lot. And it's not that it's wrong, because it's okay to like nice things. Yep. But sometimes I feel like some of these people, it's like you said, wealth has mastered them instead of being the other way around. They are trying to show people that they have it instead of just having it for themselves and being okay with that. That's why I really am drawn to this kind of quiet confidence, I like to call it. Where CEOs who take the train and stuff like that. I think there's something very nice about that.
I mean, we need to be master of our money and not become a servant. Yeah, so money, we believe, is always an enabler. It's not a goal. And as long as it enables you the lifestyle that you want to live. And if you look at money as an enabler and not a goal, we don't always have to be in that race to accumulate more. Sometimes it's about decluttering, right? And just living the life that you want to live. Yeah, so I think that's something very important for us to understand. It's not always, you know, I just want to accumulate more and more and more and more.
That's
and
right.
More. I've not heard of many consumers that will tell me, you know, my advisor is very good because he's very flashy. He drives big car, so he is very successful. Right? Yeah. I think consumers today, they are smarter. When they look at the advisors, if you're very flashy, in their mind they must be thinking, well, you're making a lot of money off me.
Making a lot of money
off other people, right? So I can say, yeah, you're doing well in terms of sales. But I'm not sure.
Am I doing well?
Yeah, but I'm not sure whether consumers will feel like, oh, that means you are advising me very well.
That's interesting because I've met financial advisors who told me like, hey, bro, you know, I tried this like education thing. I tried to be like humble, don't brag about it, but I didn't get any leads. So I guess like it does still work for certain segments of the audience. Because in the end, like this financial advisor I know, he went back to like the flashy route, you know. You post with a watch, then you.
No, actually, I mean, that's a good point.
There are only so few, you know, flashy photos. Sorry, you're gonna say.
No, so to add on to that, right? And you can confirm that this is true. Because in our sector, there's something like that also. In the financial content sector,
personal finance, yeah.
If you are very hypey and you shout like, "Oh, I can earn you this amount and invest in this, sure go up, and you can get how many percent returns," right? I feel like that kind of content strategy, you can get people faster, but in the long run, something will happen where your reputation will run out or something, you know? And I suspect that. Is that the case when people choose one of these two? So your case might take longer to build, you know, but it's very steady.
Yeah, so I was about to say that, which you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, it can be faster, but is it sustainable? That's one. Secondly, are you really happy doing this? Is this who you are, really? I mean, for me, I want to do something that is sustainable, and I want to be happy doing what I'm doing.
You can sleep at night, right?
sleep at night, and I want to enjoy my conversation with my clients for the next 10, 20 years.
Wow.
Right? So that's very important for me. I don't want to pretend to be a person. I mean, okay, if you are the kind who are naturally fleshy and you really enjoy doing that, okay, maybe it works for you. So, I mean, for us, okay, we don't golf. We never had to go out to the golf course there to golf with clients to get business.
Mm.
We don't meet clients out there in expensive restaurants.
Mm.
All our clients come to our office to do the meetings. But we have one of the richest clients you can find in Singapore.
Mm.
Right? And why is it they are with us, and why are they not at the private banks?
Right.
Because they don't feel that they need to be out there telling their friends that, you know, I've got three private bankers serving me. I've got Provident. You know how Provident? It's fine. You know?
Right. I love that. Yeah.
So it's the same kind of people that we attract, like I said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, were you always like this? Because I feel like Provident and also the way you run it is an extension of the kind of personality that you have. Like, how did you grow up, and like, what was money like in your childhood? What did your parents do and stuff like that?
Yeah. So I grew up with three other siblings. My father was a bus driver. My father came to Singapore from Malacca when he was very young. I think when he was like 14, 16 years old.
Mm.
And he faked his age so that he could get a job with a company that most young people would not have heard of. It's called the Singapore Traction Company, STC, which is trams.
Oh shit, that's
cool. We had trams in Singapore, in Po Tui, which is a city.
Trams?
Trams, yeah, we have trams. Yeah, Singapore Tractor, or Traction, STC.
Traction. Oh, that's very cool. Because nowadays you think traction is like social media traction or something, right?
Yeah.
The Singapore Traction Company.
So my father was a roadman. So he told me, you know, those days not computerized, when the train has to change track, you need a pulley system to change the track. Like, I don't know how
it's literally a very manual and
manual
mechanical process.
That's right. So that was his first job in Singapore. And then subsequently, of course, SBS came about. He became a conductor.
Mm.
I used to go on the bus with him when he was a conductor. It was very cool, you know, with the
ticket.
I kept that for a while, you know, until it became rusty and I threw it away. And then he became a bus driver. And at the peak of his driving career, he was OMO, one-man operation. So OMO was something he was very proud of because he had to learn, he said in his words, computer.
Mm.
Okay, it's basically just a button to press.
Computer.
He called it computer.
But actually, it's more of a mechanical system.
It's not digital. No. So, but he was very proud of himself because he was selected, you know, to operate that thing.
Upskill, right?
And I accompanied him. He was driving Bus 143, and I used to accompany him.
I always take Bus 143 to Jurong East.
I think it goes to Haw Par Villa, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah. Jurong East, West Coast, then goes to Dhoby Ghaut.
Is it Toa Payoh? Ends at Toa Payoh or something like that. I cannot remember.
Wow.
But I used to stand behind his seat, and I would, those days I think was still allowed, you know, when people put their coins in, I help him press the button. That's quite cool, right? So I grew up in that kind of family, and my mother was a homemaker. My father was earning like maybe 600 bucks. So we don't have a lot. Back in those days, chicken rice is a huge celebration. So we have chicken rice once a month at Toa Payoh Interchange. This bus driver, they are given vouchers to go to supermarket.
Mm.
Those days, the supermarket wasn't NTUC FairPrice. It was called Silo. If you go and Google, you'll still find Silo.
Wow.
All these things you never hear about.
Yeah, those are history.
History lesson.
So bus drivers, they are given a voucher, like $100. Wow, and that was like the treat of the month, because that's when my mom would say, okay, each one of you can buy one tidbit. Yeah. Right, and then my siblings, you know, we were like, okay, we don't get the same stuff. Okay, you get this, you get this.
Diversify.
Yeah, then we go back, then we share our tidbits. And after the chicken rice, we get to share like ice ball or one ice kacang. The whole family will share. Ice ball is like those days, like ice kacang inside of nothing. They put the ball literally on your hand.
Got syrup.
Yeah, so you would eat.
So you just quickly eat.
Then you wash your hand on the pail of water at the hawker center. But that was like the treat of the
best
month. The month. And then I still remember, the thing that I remember very vividly was we had to wait for my father to come back from work, like last car, he drives his bus to I don't know where.
Yeah.
Then he will go to a restaurant and buy those chicken whereby the meats, they have all skin off. So you literally just buy the bird with a bit of meat and the bones. Mm-hmm. It costs $1.
Mm.
And then we'll wake up in the middle of the night, 1:30, 2 o'clock, to eat the bird. We never had cakes.
Right.
We used to buy Hokkien, we call it cake cui la. That means they cut the butter cake at the side,
right.
Okay, the remnants, and they sell it in a big packet for like 20 cents.
Wow.
So that's the kind of life.
Right.
My mother always go to the market at like 10, 11 o'clock just to pick the remaining of the vegetable.
Mm.
That's a lot cheaper. Mm. So that was my background. Obviously, not rich. And so like I said, I cannot pretend to be rich. I cannot pretend to live the kind of lifestyle that the wealthy live, because I don't know how they live.
Then when you started to earn like 200K plus when you were 30 years old, like wouldn't that be such like a culture shock to you?
Yeah.
And how do you manage the transition? And how do you, like, do you still manage your money the same way, you know, after you started earning like a lot more back then?
I mean, 200,000 was really, really a lot of money. Actually, I really don't know how to manage it. Like anyone who was young, I wanted to upgrade my lifestyle.
Mm.
And that was actually what I did. So when I was with the insurance company, I started upgrading my car.
Mm.
I bought a bigger car, and then I bought a condo. So I got caught as well, right? I sold my 5-year HDB flat,
right,
and upgraded to a condo. But the turnaround came, I think, in 2000 and after the GFC.
2008
after the GFC.
Mm.
When the GFC came, I did a huge sort of like checkup of my life. And then I suddenly realized, what has become of me, you know? Although I was still prudent,
yeah.
But then I realized I got caught. So about, I think it must be 2010, I decided to go on a massive downgrading.
Yeah.
Were you hit by the GFC?
Of course, yeah. The firm was definitely hit by the GFC.
But you were still okay, lah.
We were not okay, actually.
Right, we were doing
quite badly.
I see.
Because almost 90% of our revenue comes from investment management fees.
I see.
Right, and then the market brought it down. So our revenues, it got affected.
Mm.
But okay, we survived, right? Mm. We survived. But it was a period of a lot of reflection.
Mm. But if you wanted to, you probably could have struggled but kept up all these additional things.
Yes, I could have.
Two cars, condo can support on.
Condo definitely can.
Mm.
The cars, I wasn't...
Maybe let one go.
Maybe let one go. But the condo, no problem. I mean, there were a few things I learned through the GFC. One of the things I've learned is that I can work very hard, I can be very smart, but sometimes you have no control over market, right? Be humble. Don't go out there. So sometimes I when I see some of the posting the last few years, right, by advisors, that they are so confident of the markets and the way they can get returns. People will write like, you come to me, I can get, you know, my portfolio is delivering 20% and all that. It's a reminder for me like, okay, don't be so confident.
Right.
You don't know what you don't know.
Because you cannot hit before, like 2008. Like,
yeah,
right.
So we can work very hard and we think we are really very smart. But be humble, because you just don't know the markets enough. La. That was one of the learning points. But of course, the other learning point is when I look at my life, I realized that, I'm caught, you know, I'm caught in this whole wealth trap, right? Mm. I wasn't doing it to show off, but it's like, okay, now I earn more.
Feels good. Right?
Surely I deserve a better life, right?
Yeah.
And a better life means, okay, I should have one more car and I should stay in a private property. But thank God, I had a chance to reverse everything. La. So I think it must be 2010 or so. I started selling down my car. I sold one car and then retained one, and then I moved back to a HDB.
Yeah, I think sometimes in your like 30s or when you're earning a lot of money, you start to think like this will go on forever, right? Or whether or not, like for example, most recently during the pandemic, like your stocks go up, you think it'll go up forever. But sometimes in that moment, you make decisions that you think, based on like a future where growth is forever. Mm. And often, like, it comes to bite you in the ass. Mm. Maybe like 10 years down the line or something. Like
yeah.
That.
And I guess we all need to know our trade-offs. Now, I'm not saying that you should not stay in a property, you cannot have two cars.
Of course, yeah.
If you are able, you are financially able to do it, and mm-hmm. by doing it, it's just a really small percentage of your wealth or your income. Yeah, by all means, do it, right? And you are able to manage your time well, such that when you earn that income, you're not trading off other more important things.
Mm.
But I wasn't doing it that way,
yeah.
right? Because I was working so hard, trying to make the money, trying to make the firm work.
Right.
And the trade-off for me was my time at home. I wasn't spending a lot of time at home. And my kids were growing up.
Mm.
Wouldn't it be better to think about maybe not necessarily giving the kid the best that society deems, but sort of spending more time with the kid yourself?
Mm.
And come to that trade-off, if I have kids in the future, I really don't know what the right answer is. Because I feel like sometimes in Singapore, it seems like you should do everything you can and more to give your kid the best that they can get. But what is the best? You know, I also don't know.
I mean,
so how do you raise your kids?
To most kids, the best thing they can have is really your time. Really that. I have to say that I wasn't a very good father when my kids were younger because I wasn't present. I was busily running the business and trying to make sure that the business survived.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. But when I realized it, thankfully, my kids, they were still young.
Mm.
And so there was 180 degrees change. I was present with them for all the important milestones of their life. Both my kids are sports people.
I saw that your son was recently competing.
Yes, he plays for the Singapore floorball team, and recently he went to Cambodia for his SEA Games.
Wow.
My daughter used to be playing competitive basketball for school all the way until the polytechnic.
Wow.
And so my wife and me, we made sure that almost every game at least, no matter how busy I am, we will be there for them. If we can travel there, we'll travel there, which is what we did for Cambodia and previously we went to Manila for his SEA Games.
Yeah.
So those are important milestones, and your kids appreciate that most about you, I feel.
I think that's wonderful because I've heard of many stories where the parents go all out to like, you know, get like the best for the kids, the best in their mind. So like enrichment class, go to the best school, give like the most tuition.
We give very little. So, I mean, tuition, when my kids were young, we asked them, we gave them a choice, right? And we asked them, do you need help in this area? If you need help, happy to give you tuition. If you can manage on your own, we are fine. Both my wife and me, we are not those that focus a lot on academic. Now, it doesn't mean we don't care, right? But we just look at the academic side as just a part of their lives.
Yeah.
And for me, I have this very weird feeling, which many parents, they a weird thinking, which many parents, they may not agree with me.
Yeah.
I always tell my wife, we know our kids very well. Okay? If they are very lousy in their schoolwork, give them all the help they need. Give them tuition.
Mm.
If they are very, very good and they can be a scholar, give them all the support so that they can be, you know, they can reach their full potential.
Yeah.
But look at our children. They are like us. They are above average, right? And no matter how much tuition you give them, okay, they are not going to be the top 5%.
Mm.
Right.
Okay, we know it wouldn't be. Okay, it doesn't mean they're stupid. They are just better in other things.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right? So give them a childhood instead, right? Because they're not going to enjoy all those tuition and all those enrichment classes that we think they enjoy.
Yeah.
But actually, maybe we are just trying to make them our trophies.
Yeah.
Right.
So that when they achieve certain things, we can go and show off these trophies to our peers, right? And say, my son went to this school and then got this and all that, right? But don't make them our trophies, you know? So we just want to give them a childhood. My daughter now is in Melbourne. And I just had lunch with a friend 2 days ago, and so my friend asked me, "Hey, how is she doing?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" "I don't know her grades at all."
"Yeah."
You didn't ask her?" I said, "I've never asked her about her grades since when she started school in poly. Secondary school, we know lah, right?
Yeah, because of the
report card.
But I've never asked them about grades at all. Why? Because it's not important for me. What's important for me, I always tell my children, is you do your best and you pass and you progress in life. That's all I need. Is that the right thing to do? I don't know. But I think the biggest encouragement I got from my kids was a couple of years ago. One day when we were walking back, I don't know, from the park, and suddenly my daughter said, next time if I have children, I want to bring them up like the way you brought us up.
Wow, okay.
You know, no, no,
that is
no
the
stress.
Best thing you can hear.
Yeah, that's the best thing. I feel that, that in that regard, we have done the right thing.
It really hit me hard when you said that your daughter said, I will raise my kids exactly like you, because I think that is probably one of the best things you can get as feedback. Because I think about my parents, and I love them, and they're fine, you know. I don't think I will say that, you know. I will take on some of the parts that about my upbringing that I really like, but some parts I'll also filter out for my kids. But to hear that, I'm just going to do what you do, carry that forward, means that you probably did a lot of things right.
I encourage you, go and tell your parents that part that you felt they have brought you up well, because for parents, right? We don't say that enough, but when our kids say that, right, wow, it's actually very, very encouraging. And I have no chance to say that to my parents. I mean, both of them passed away the last few years. I wish I did, that I have a chance to tell my mother, Ma, you know, because you were so thrifty and I saw you doing this, you know, that was the values that, actually, the part about I just wanted to pass came from my mother. When I was studying, my mother also never insisted that you must get A.
So it's actually passed down twice.
Yes. My mother never used me as a trophy.
Wow.
I wasn't a trophy at all for her, but at least she didn't have that desire to want to use me as a trophy. When I was young, my mother always just tell me that 只要你及格, 就可以. So I think because of that, it's the same way I brought up my kids.
My mom said a very similar thing, not the past. She said, just try your best. And she always said that, if you try your best, I have no issues with whatever grade you get.
Yeah, so go and tell your mother. And I remember the last podcast, right? You said, hey, Wei Chun, 你不要跟我读到笨, right? I still remember that, you know? I still remember
that's right, that's right.
Because that comes from a mother with a lot of wisdom and a lot of love.
Because
sometimes parents push their children so hard, right? And forget what actually is the most important.
Yeah, and I think actually, I'm not going to say this on her behalf, but I do think you are a trophy, as in she should be proud of you because of the things you've achieved. I think the difference here is that our parents didn't try to mold us into the trophy that they wanted. They sort of let us be us and be the best version of ourselves. And I think that's maybe sometimes the best you can hope for.
I think it's about the intention, right? You can't raise the kids with the intention of it. Sorry, I said it, of them being a trophy. But then if they happen to be a trophy along the way, then that's just
good
a bonus,
good
right? Good for you.
And it reminds me of something that Rui Ming did, what you said, which I think is a very good reminder, and something that I'm trying to work my way around. Like Asian parents, I think maybe a bit more difficult. Classically, like, they don't talk as much. They don't do the American, I sit down with you on the bed, like, what's really going on kind of thing. So there's a lot of love there that is not said, that you should make the attempt to say when they're still alive. And it's very difficult for me, because I think my parents, especially my dad, he rejects this kind of outpouring of love. So there are a lot of instances where I try to tell him and he doesn't take it well. But Rui Ming did a thing where he went with his dad to a holiday.
Yeah, so I took my dad on a road trip. And I think like my dad also is not a very like sharing man. But I think on the road trip, sometimes you just drive for like hundreds and hundreds of kilometers.
He's exactly like that.
Yeah. And then in the end, like we will fill the silence with conversation. So it's a good way to make your dad start talking.
Yeah, but which I want to encourage you as well, because I'm also like your dad. I don't know how to relate to my children emotionally. You know, and my son may watch this and he will remember, because I feel yucky when my son put his hand around me.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. And I have friends who ask me, why are you so weird? You know, if you have your son who is old enough and he still does that to you, you should be very grateful. But maybe because that was the way I relate to my father.
Yes, yes.
So I don't know how to.
Yes.
And sometimes I feel bad because I can allow my daughter to do that because I feel okay.
Yeah.
But but for my son, I feel weird.
It's like a 男子汉 kind of thing, is it?
Yeah, yeah, and like it's wrong.
It must be tough.
Yes, I'm not saying it's correct. It's wrong, yeah. Right? But because my son will keep doing it, maybe in other forms, was sold out.
And that's right.
And that's the most important. So whatever facade we put,
yes.
Right, like we put across, right? Like, okay, I'm very tough, you know. Yeah, you know, why you like that?
What
right?
It means to be a man, to be a man, male mentor to another person that you bring up.
Yeah, and I just want to encourage you that as a father, I feel it. And
I'm sure he feels it. Yeah,
I know. That. Yeah, and for the sons, right? It is the way. It is the father's love. We are just trying to teach you to be a man, but we have no model in our life. We have no role model in our life to teach us how to be a father, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So,
I think I know for damn sure he gets it. It's just also I think I'm a bit more westernized also, you know. And then he's quite a hardcore China supporter, so he has certain values that is very different from me, you know. So when we try to communicate our love, it's very different. Like, I still remember the first time he said, I love you to me. It was like when he was in a thing in America, then we were on a call together. And then the I love you was such a, it's like he slipped it in at the last moment when we were about to hang out, you know, bye, Asan, take care, okay, I love you. I didn't even get the chance to say back, you know. Yeah. I think he is sort of, icked up, but I think that is exactly it.
Yeah, so thanks how to for say, saying it to me. Yeah, also. Weird lah. I mean, I also don't know how to say it to. I tell you, the last 2 weeks, I've been forced to say I love you to my daughter.
What do you mean forced? Yeah.
Forced because I don't always say that, right? And then I don't know what happened. I think between my wife and my daughter, maybe my daughter was telling my wife, Papa never say I love you. Okay, so now my wife will take the, because my daughter FaceTime us every day, right? So she will take the FaceTime thing and say, hey, say I love you. Say I love you.
Yeah,
I was like, I love you.
I think you have to normalize it. Because I think I started saying I love you to my dad, and I think like 10 years ago.
Yes.
Then in the beginning, it's just like, oh, like exactly what Wei Chun said. I just slip it in like, okay, bye, I love you, bye. Then eventually, it just became like a normal thing. Then now like, then when I hug him, like he will behave like funnily. But then now when I meet him, we just like, hi, bye, I love you. That was when you, goodbye, he'll give me a hug and everything.
Wow, good job, man.
Yeah, so.
He gave that gift to me, you know. Like, he first told me I love you. And I was like,
what is this? Okay, just for clarification. Yeah, I also say I love you to my close friends. Yeah,
Every time we leave, every day, he will say I love you. So, it will weirded me out at first also. But it opened me up to now. Now I have the ability to say friends.
Great job, man.
I say to my guy because he gave it to me.
Well,
he passed it to me.
I if he said that to me, I also feel well. How come it's a guy saying?
I guess it's a bit weird in the beginning, but then I just say lah. Then
thank you, Remy. Yeah. I love you, man.
Yeah, I love you, man.
Great job,
normalizing.
Guys.
Yeah. Job, normalization.
Guys. I don't know why we are talking about this topic. Great job, man.
Or maybe like at this point, like, I want to come back to the idea of maybe some takeaways that we can have for our listeners. So I think like I like this kind of like finance experts that are not that we can trust as laymen, you know. And I think you have that certain aspect to you. And you said that you manage money for the affluent. So maybe just to have a sort of a takeaway thing, like what is something that somebody can do as a fresh grad when it comes to money? Do we go and look for somebody to help us, or is advisory no point until we reach a certain point? And what is that point?
I feel if you're a fresh graduate, right, and many fresh graduates today, they are so internet savvy, you can actually really do a lot of these things yourself. I don't really feel that you need advice. You probably need an advisor to help you transact. Right, so you need a guy to help you buy lah, because a lot
broker,
of things. I mean like insurance, right? I mean, you can't really buy online. You probably need an advisor to help you transact, but you can do a lot of things yourself because it's really simple, right? So I tell that to my son. I mean, my son is 25 years old, fresh graduate, right? So a few things I tell him: make sure you save up money for emergency. We always tell people 3 to 6 months, right? Make sure you budget. Right, and at your age, you should be at least saving 50% of your income, right? Because you have no liabilities, no mortgage, no children to raise up, right? You can save a lot of money, right? And then once you have all this emergency fund, you can buy the safe things. You can buy Singapore savings bonds. Nowadays, you can buy T-bills. So have money in these very safe instruments. And after you have done that, you can try your hand on investment. Right? And the easiest thing to do is go and buy an ETF. Right? You don't want to buy, you just go and buy an ETF that tracks the MSCI All Country World Index or track the FTSE World Index. You know, it's so easy. Open a brokerage account and just buy. Start small, 1,000, you know, and all that. And then insurance at your age, not much liabilities. Then just make sure you have a good hospitalization plan, right? A Shield plan, right? And if you really think that you want to buy a life insurance that protect you against loss of income for your family due to death and all that, we have all served NS. Go and buy the Singlife Aviva group insurance, right? Yeah. Not complicated, right? Then you're done already.
Right.
It's very basic, right?
Yeah.
All done, right? Okay, then after you have done all that, then you slowly go and explore more complicated things. If you really think you are interested in crypto, okay, go and study a bit more, you know. I'm not supporting crypto. I'm just saying you need to try your hands on something and you can learn it, right?
Take reasonable risk, right?
Yeah, yeah. But you build a foundation and the foundation is not at all complicated for you, right? Your CPF, you probably won't have a lot of things to do with your CPF because your CPF balances will be low and you probably need to set that aside for buying your first property, you know, all that. So you see, for a fresh graduate, not complicated. You can do it yourself.
Then at what point should somebody think about advisory?
I think as your wealth starts to grow and you have a family, then life becomes more complicated. You have children. And now you have to take care of your family, your parents, and you start to need to accumulate for the future. Then things like estate planning becomes a bit more important. Then I would say maybe someone in the 30s, things become a bit more complex, then you probably need to get a really good advisor to map that out for you.
So last question from me, I wanted to ask you this because you manage the wealth of the affluent. What are rich people like? And are there some misconceptions about rich people that we kind of usually get wrong?
Yeah, I was thinking about this question and I have to prepare for it because I feel that it's not an easy question to answer.
Yeah, I'm being very general, of course, so this is just a general thing.
So, again, my observations are probably general.
Yep.
And maybe it's biased towards those clients that come to us. I realize that for the many very wealthy clients that we serve, they don't buy things that they don't need, even though they have the money to impress the people they don't know. Okay, that's the first thing I observe. So they come very simply dressed. They don't feel like they need to impress anyone at all. So that's the first thing. They definitely live below their means. Okay, so they obviously can...
their means are very high, man, right?
Yes, but they still live below their means. The rich has their rich toys. And a person who does not live below their means can spend all their money buying those rich toys. So conceptually, it's the same. Right? So, but the rich, that at least I see the real rich, not the wannabe. The really wealthy ones are the ones that they can buy a GCB, but they don't. They stay in a much smaller house that they can afford. So that's what I mean by living below. Living within means I earn $1, I spend $1. Below means I earn $1, I don't have to spend $1. I can spend 50 cents, but I don't spend 50 cents. I still choose to spend 10 cents. Right. So that's the second point. The third one is that they take time to be financially literate.
Wow.
The wealthy ones, I have not heard my wealthy clients coming to me and say, you know, I don't like numbers, man. I don't understand the thing about numbers. You know, so you guys do it for me. They actually know enough to ask us good questions. So they take time to be financially literate. They choose advisors based on values and philosophies in alignment. Right?
Yeah.
That's very important for them. Next is that they spend a lot of time doing due diligence before they decide on one or two advisors. But once they have decided our advisors, they leave us alone. So when markets become, you know, really volatile, they don't bother us. They don't really call us, right? We call them, in fact, and they say, okay, no worry, Chris, we are okay. I guess that's how they become successful in the first place.
Yeah.
Right. They empower their own staff probably to do the
outsourcing.
They don't micromanage.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. So these are some of the things that we notice about the wealthy ones. The rich, the wealthy ones also have what I call this mindset of abundance. They believe that they have enough resources out there to accomplish their goals, and they are contented, and they don't compare.
Mm.
They don't go and compare with other people. And they have this sharing mindset as well. They're generous enough to share. Now, again, the counter-argument would be, of course, you got so much money.
Yes.
Mm.
But no, right? Because I can have a lot of money, I can still buy expensive toys, I can also be very niao and don't share, right? So I realized that the kind of clients that we serve, somehow they are like that.
Mm.
Like I said, I'm just being general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you know of rich people, for example, who are also rich but not happy in the way that they might compare upwards? Because I feel like it's infinite, right? You can keep comparing upwards.
Definitely. I have met people who are wealthy, but not financially secure.
Wow.
They have a lot of money, but they are always afraid of not having enough.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes it's because of the journey of life they have gone through.
Yeah.
Right? And that affects them psychologically. They can have millions of dollars in the bank, but they are always afraid that the money will run out, and therefore they are never happy.
Right. Mm. That's a great point, because I was also wondering, like, when we talk about, there's this term that we use a lot, which is financial independence or financial freedom.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of times, and necessarily so, we tie that to a number, a certain amount of number, then returning at, say, 4%, like the 4% rule, for example, then that means you're independent because your passive number coming in is bigger than what you spend.
Mm.
But I also feel like, in some ways, right, I suspect that there is no real certainty in life, because you can be as prepared as anything, and then something may happen, like an illness in your family, and then that might just capsize your whole thing, because there's this whole aspect of life that you can't control.
Yeah, right.
So I was also wondering, and you can correct me if my suspicion you disagree with, and I would love to hear the disagreement, that financial freedom or financial independence, but I mean more freedom, right? It's also a state of mind. It doesn't mean like I need to have a lot of money, then I can be settled. It means that I can be someone who still has to work for a living, but I know the money coming in and the money going out, and I'm spending below my means, and I'm okay.
Yeah.
And then I should feel peace in my life, even though I have not achieved a lot of money yet.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say it any better, Wei-Chun. I agree with you. A lot has got to do with expenses.
Right. Yeah.
If you keep your expenses low enough, then you will always feel secure. Right? You can earn a lot.
Mm.
But if you don't watch your expenses and you spend a lot,
what's the point?
Yeah, then what's the point?
I think like financial independence, like you need a number.
Independence.
Yeah, because you need, I mean, it's kind of like at a point where, let's say your returns exceed your expenses.
Right, because what independence mean, right? I'm independent.
Because you don't need to work.
Right.
But I think what you speak of is financial security. Mm. So security, even though you don't have a lot of money yet, you can have like some sort of like calmness, because you know like, you know what, I can earn money, I will invest, I have the right habits, I spend very little, I'll get through no matter what crisis it is.
Yeah. And that's why, and I'm going to sort of like answer this question that you may not ask me, because you did ask me whether financial literacy should be taught in school.
Yeah.
My answer is yes. But what I'm afraid is, in typical Singapore, we like to teach the how and not the why.
Mm.
Okay, because whenever we talk about financial literacy, it's about how do we budget, how do we buy insurance, how do we invest? I think, yes, we should definitely teach financial literacy in school, because it's an important life skill. But beyond teaching the how, we need to teach the why. Mm. Instead of teaching just the doing, we need to teach the being. Because the being is important, right? And the being is what we talk about. The being is about the philosophy of sufficiency, the philosophy of abundance, about gratefulness, about contentment, all those things. Because these are the things that will help a person be financially secure.
Right.
Not just the how, because as I mentioned, I've met people who are very rich.
Yeah.
They obviously know the how and they have accumulated a lot of money, but they still don't feel secure.
Mm.
Right? So we need to teach financial literacy holistically, so that people know how to do, but they also know how to be. I need to share this because I did an interview on this young man, 27, 28 years old, and you might have read about him. His name is Joshua. And during COVID, he traveled 55 countries.
Wow.
When he started traveling, he was only 25.
Mm.
And he went to all those very exotic places. But the one thing that he said that hit me was this. He said everything that he needs to buy, he needs to fit it into his backpack.
Mm.
Wow. That's a great analogy of life.
Yeah.
Right? Because we need to first decide the backpack that we want to carry in our life.
Yeah.
And once we decide the backpack that we want to carry, then everything is planned based on that backpack.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. So he doesn't spend extra. So even if I like certain things, I won't buy it because it will not fit.
It won't fit. I can't bring it.
I can't carry. Right. There's no point.
And the size of the backpack that you decide is based on the amount of countries you want to travel.
Yes, he said, and he said, I can't buy it too big because some certain carrier, they won't carry this big
then
backpack.
My country
right?
won't be 55, it'll be like 30 or 25.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
yeah.
And it determines like where you can go, how far you can go, how fast you can go.
How fast, yes, exactly.
And also, I guess, some people's current backpack is like their house.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, right? Yeah. A house full of stuff.
We end up buying a lot of things that we can't carry in our lives. There's no point. It's just wasted.
That's great. I'll link the episode in the description also. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, no worries.
Okay. Thank you for being a guest on our show.
No, it's a pleasure.
Yeah. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, maybe you can think about liking and subscribing. If this happens to be the last podcast we ever do, because like Rimming said, we become a dry leaf flying around in the whims of society, then thank you so much for supporting us all this one. Thank you very much again, Christopher, for
thank
being
you.
On
thank
the
you
show.
For having me.
And if you enjoyed like this conversation with Chris, you can also check out his podcast, which we will also link in the description.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that shout out.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.